Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show we have historian Kara Rogers Stevens, and we'll be discussing her recent book, Thomas Jefferson and the Fight Against Slavery. Kara teaches at Ashland University, and her research focuses on race and slavery in the Jeffersonian age. Her recent book, this book, Thomas Jefferson and the Fight Against Slavery, is published by the Kansas University Press, and it won the Herbert J. Storing Book Prize and was a finalist for the Center of Presidential History's Book Prize and runner-up for the Journal of American Revolution's Book Award and the finalist for the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History's George Washington Prize. No short list. That's very impressive. The book examines what Jefferson did and did not do to end slavery and bring equality to America. So, Kara, thank you for joining History 605.
Thank you so much for having me.
With America's 250th coming up, I've been doing some episodes on the nation's founding and heard of this book via our mutual friend, Al Zambon. And so thanks for joining us here today. It was a fascinating read, and I hope it has some impact on people as they think about the Declaration of Independence and the words that are in that founding document. How did you get interested in this? A little bit, what's your background and what drew you to write the book?
Yeah, so the short answer is I was completing my PhD in history at Rice University down in Houston, and I needed a topic. And I was interested in Thomas Jefferson, but how do you say something new about such a famous figure? And I had a fantastic dissertation advisor who said, well, nobody has written a intellectual biography of Thomas Jefferson's book, Notes on the State of Virginia. And so that was how this began, was looking into the history of this book that Jefferson wrote in the 1780s. Yeah. And it turns out that there are parts of the book that I find very boring. And the most interesting part of the book is the sections that have to do with race on slavery, the most okay. interesting to me. And so the project turned into an intellectual biography of Notes on the State of Virginia, but particularly focusing on the ways in which Jefferson changed this book over time to make it a very pointed attack on the institution of slavery, especially in Virginia. Mm. And it became a part of a broader strategy that he had for trying to turn public opinion toward abolition. Now, the longer answer as to why I was interested in this topic is I'm an immigrant to America, and originally I was born in South Africa. And at the time that I lived there, there was a legal system of racial oppression and segregation ruling the country called apartheid. And one of the reasons my parents left is to get away from that system and to come to America to enjoy the freedoms that we have here. And so my family has always been fascinated by the founding period and the principles of the founding, especially the Declaration. And so for me, there was a real personal interest in the Declaration, Thomas Jefferson, and how could Thomas Jefferson, who owned more than 200 people over the course of his life, have also written, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. How do we square this circle? And so the dissertation was my attempt to answer that question for myself, to figure out, is Thomas Jefferson a hypocrite, or is there some way of getting into his mind and understanding his actions to make sense of the fact that he continued to own slaves and yet he was such a proponent of freedom?
Well, it's very interesting. I've heard Jeffrey Rosen speak recently, the director of the National Constitution Center.
Oh, yes.
He's got a book out. It's a wonderful book called The Pursuit of Happiness. And he has made the point that Jefferson knew he was a hypocrite, but was unable, like many other slaveholders. And he gives a quote from, I think it's Patrick Henry, or maybe George Mason, that he assumes Jefferson held that same type of view, that by the time, certainly once Jefferson left politics after the presidency and so forth, he was just so comfortable in that he couldn't see himself freeing his slaves or getting rid of the slaves. But you should sit in a room with Mr. Rosen and
oh, that would be fascinating.
Or he should read your book, because I think he would be run up against a few counterpoints to that when you have marshaled a great amount of evidence. So, well, let's get back to the notes. You ask a question that's not necessarily a new question, but you found something that reveals a new answer, which Rosen and many others didn't have access to. So why don't you, I think the listeners be interested in, this is why history changes, right? We find new evidence.
And yeah.
What did you come across, and how did you work that into your book and your research on Jefferson?
So because I was looking at doing an intellectual history of this book, Notes on the State of Virginia, I started to look into the original manuscript of this document. And I discovered that for quite a long time, historians have been working with a version of this document that is not very easily accessible. So Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote his book, he wrote out a clean copy of his draft at a specific point in time in 1783. And then from then on, every time he edited, he would sometimes scratch out and write in the margins. But if he wanted to make a larger change, he would take pieces of paper, paste them down on top of the original pages, and then the pieces of paper had to be unfolded and flipped up and then flipped down again in order to read all of Thomas Jefferson's changes and additions to this text. And the manuscript, you know, is a very delicate thing. So it was microfilmed, and historians only accessed the microfilmed version of this document for quite a while, which meant they weren't looking at every single change that Jefferson made. Finally, in 1997, this manuscript was very carefully taken apart and preserved, photographed by the Massachusetts Historical Society, and it is now digitized. You can go online and you can look at these pages of manuscript, and they've just done the most ingenious job with it, because you can click on the manuscript and see the little pieces of paper folding up and folding down and coming off and being put back. But it's now possible, as a researcher sitting in the comfort of your own home, to see these hundreds of words that were obscured for all of those scholars using the microfilmed version. So what I did is I looked at this manuscript, and then I also looked at the history of when did Jefferson make different changes. And what's possible then to discover is that Jefferson significantly altered the text after he received some feedback from a friend, Charles Thompson, who was a scientist, an intellectual, and a member of secretary of the Continental Congress. Charles Thompson read Jefferson's manuscript and wrote back to him and said, "You know what? I love what you have to say here, especially the things that you say about the races." Jefferson has this whole section on the white race, the black race, and how he thinks that perhaps the white race is superior, which was the kind of going scientific consensus at the time. And Jefferson said, "Yeah, this is probably right. The white race is probably superior in all of these different ways." Charles Thompson writes to Jefferson and says, "You know, I like what you have to say, but because I think that you are right, and because such an opinion might seem to support slavery, I would remove it." In other words, Jefferson, sure, there's science out there about race that seems correct, and you're summarizing the stuff about race. But a casual reader might look at this and think that you're using this to justify slavery, and I don't think that's what you're trying to do. Well, Jefferson isn't trying to justify slavery, and so he didn't completely take Charles Thompson's advice. He didn't delete the whole section, but he significantly changes the manuscript before and after he gets this letter. And what the effect of his changes is to drastically soften his speculations on race. He adds phrases like, "This is a suspicion only. Further research is needed."
Yeah.
He adds a couple of ways in which he feels that the black race is equal to or superior to the white race. And then he doubles in length the chapter condemning slavery. And he puts in some of the strongest language condemning slavery and calling for liberty of any of the founding fathers. Mm-hmm. And so when you view Jefferson's changes, this is all in the notes. And so when you know that Jefferson makes these changes specifically in response to this critique from his friend, that he specifically doesn't want to be seen as supporting slavery, it gives us a new perspective on the document. And then you can put that in connection with looking at Jefferson's correspondence and how he was telling people that he wanted to send his book specifically to young men at the College of William and Mary because he hoped that they would be persuaded to change the laws and free the slaves of Virginia. He'd given up on his own generation, but he believed that younger men could still be influenced and that his book might have a role to play in influencing them. And then the final piece of this was looking to see whether that strategy worked. So I examined Jefferson's relationships with several younger men and particularly looked at men at the College of William and Mary to see, did any of them become anti-slavery as a result of what Jefferson said or did? And the answer is yes. There's young men that Jefferson had personal relationships with who became anti-slavery partly as a result of their relationships with him or at least encouraged in their anti-slavery by Jefferson. Mm-hmm. And there's young men who didn't know him personally, but who read his book at the College of William and Mary and said it persuaded them to become anti-slavery.
Well, let's finish that the bit about the publishing the notes. Then he writes this over a period of time in response to a question that's kind of a sociological research question, right? I mean, I guess in the university world, they would call this putting out a call to say, hey, I'm going to do a publication and we'd like to publish chapters from around the world about these things to tell us about Virginia or tell us about New York or tell us about Scotland. And this call goes out from this gentleman in France. Can you describe what was the ultimate goal of this publication as thought of by the person who put out the call for all this research and descriptions?
Yeah, so the French, as I'm sure your audience will know, the French were aiding America during the American Revolution.
Yeah.
And so the secretary of the French delegation, a gentleman named Marbois, put out a call to all of the different 13 colonies, or at the time they were becoming independent states, asking them for 22 facts about their states, essentially. So there's a list of 22 questions, and it covered everything from the geography to the soil to the population to the religion to the culture. Just asking for some basic information because French people didn't know all that much about Americans. In fact, Americans didn't know all that much about Americans. They were such a brand new nation. And so much was still to be discovered about this little unit of 13 new independent states. Mm-hmm. So Marbois sends out this questionnaire to the different members of the Continental Congress, and the different states have a chance to reply to him. And only three that I have found took the time to actually write anything down.
Okay.
And Jefferson by far wrote the longest response.
Oh, sure.
And then not only did he respond to this questionnaire, but then he said for the next several years, he spent time refining his answers, rewriting the questions, and turning it into basically one of his most eloquent political statements, as well as a great collection of information about Virginia, the state that he loved.
Yeah. I had heard of the notes on the state of Virginia all my life, since college or high school. But I never knew what prompted him to write it and to find out that it was this kind of
questionnaire.
Fill out this questionnaire and tell me about Virginia. And oh, by the way, he's not just kind of a typical Virginian. He's the governor of Virginia.
Yes, that's right.
During the American Revolution. So it would be like a governor of a state today answering the call to help publish an encyclopedia or something.
It's just, yes.
But he can't help but be the overachiever, I guess, and knock it out of the park.
He was already kind of keeping lots of lists of statistics and data on Virginia. He had a collection of the state's history and memoranda on its government. So he was the perfect person to receive this questionnaire.
When Marbois got the result back from Jefferson, what did he think of it?
That's an excellent question. I actually don't know of a personal response from him.
Okay.
I just know that Jefferson told friends in France, in the academic circles of France, that he was working on this project, and that in the process of writing this, he was inspired to not only respond to the French government, but also to try to correct some misconceptions in the French scientific community regarding America. So the prevailing scientific theory of the day, propounded by a famous French scientist, was that America's climate was inferior to Europe, that America was a newer continent, but it was also colder and more damp, and that therefore all of the plants and animals were smaller in America, and that perhaps even the people were smaller, and that if Europeans moved to America, they would become over time smaller and weaker as well.
Yeah.
Well, Jefferson thinks this is ridiculous, and so he spends a lot of time collecting bones and information about different animals and samples of food so that he can prove to the French and the rest of Europe that Americans were indeed not degenerated just because of living here in this continent.
I appreciate when he becomes ambassador, he enjoys the party joke of standing up, and of course he's a very tall man, and explaining how small everything is in America, and how the men are so much smaller and people are so much smaller than the great folks in France and Europe and so forth. So,
right.
When your evidence pool is tiny, you probably best not come to grand conclusions, I suppose, like this, like that gentleman. So,
right.
Well, it's interesting too. Jefferson's anti-slavery feelings don't kind of spring forth on the day before he writes the Declaration of Independence. There's a long educational process and intellectual growth. And so you talk about, you raised the College of William and Mary and that he sent the book there. Let's talk about what's his education like and who is George with?
Yeah. So Thomas Jefferson was fairly well educated for a colonial America. His father was a kind of upper middle class planter in Virginia. And his father passed away when Jefferson was only 14 years old, and that's when Jefferson first became the inheritor of several dozen human beings and in this slave society in which he was raised. But Jefferson was able to persuade his guardians to allow him to start attending the College of William and Mary when he was still quite young, 16 or 17 years old. Off he goes, and he studied at the college at the perfect time. He happened to arrive at William and Mary just as the kind of old guard professors were leaving, some of them under a cloud of scandal, and a new kind of forerunner of the Age of Enlightenment, a gentleman called William Small, was arriving from Scotland. And Small became Jefferson's primary tutor. Small introduced the Socratic method to American universities and introduced Scottish Enlightenment theories, natural rights theories. And Jefferson ate it up and started to, we believe, embrace the ideals of all men are created equal, liberty, these different things that will later on become so prominent in American society. Jefferson embraces them at college. And fortunately, he's not only influenced by William Small, he's also influenced by a gentleman called George Wythe, who becomes America's first law professor. And George Wythe is also famously opposed to slavery. And Jefferson spends his time either with Small or Wythe, or the two of these older gentlemen would take Jefferson along to the governor's mansion, and they spent time with the governor of Virginia at the time, a gentleman called Francis Fauquier, and they all played in a little musical quartet together. And Jefferson later on remembered that these men really shaped his views of the world, and they all happened to be opposed to slavery.
Was the governor's mansion in Williamsburg?
That's right, yes.
So it can be visited today by people who go to Williamsburg,
Yes,
so
absolutely.
I've stood in that mansion. I had a couple of tours and see the harpsichord in there, so they would have been in that room.
I believe
that's on the west side, if I have my orientation properly.
Yeah, and I think that the building that you visit when you go to Colonial Williamsburg is a reconstruction, because the original had a fire that severely damaged it, I believe, after Jefferson lived there as governor. But you still do get a good idea of what it would have been like. Yeah.
Right. So what is, I guess he's, if he's a young man who owns slaves, he's at the age of, what you say, 15, 14? He comes
14 when he first inherited,
Yeah. And now he's getting these education, and he comes to this conclusion that this is we must eradicate slavery. How is a person to go about that?
Excellent question.
Because this is the real dilemma, right? That's the real dilemma. He thinks through this, and as you explain in your book, he can't, if he frees them, and this is not to be making excuses or anything, but it doesn't necessarily improve their life unless he kind of figures out a way to get them off to Pennsylvania or Canada or someplace. He's got a grander thing than just kind of signing a document and freeing them. He has a grander idea in mind that's nationwide. And that, so I just wonder he seems to be not only thinking of his own slaves, but also the entire institution of slavery. And what are the barriers to eradicating the institution of slavery?
Yeah, that's such an excellent way of thinking about it. So to your first point, what is one to do? If you're living in Virginia and you're a young man in the 1760s, what are you going to do about this institution of slavery? And the answer is, you have a very uphill battle in front of you. First of all, we should remember that in the 1740s, 1750s, even the early 60s, anti-slavery sentiment was in very much the minority. There were no abolition societies, and slavery had not really been questioned in the history of humanity. It had rather been a very acceptable form of hierarchy, and the world was a very hierarchical place. Slavery was an acceptable way of dealing with other human beings in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, among Native American tribes. The only people who had really stopped enslaving one another were Western Europeans, and even they were participating in enslaving Africans and Native peoples in their colonies. So Jefferson is surrounded by people who believe that this is, you know, just another part of life. And it's in fact illegal when Jefferson first inherits human beings, it's illegal for him to free them. The only way that he could have freed those people would have been to petition the governor of Virginia and to get special permission to free individual slaves for, say, an extremely extraordinary action of heroism that could justify freeing somebody. Jefferson's first step as a young man is to attempt to get a law passed in Virginia to make it possible for one person to free their own slaves without needing to go through those hoops and get special permission. And this is what he does in 1769, and it's an epic failure. Jefferson later recalled that he tried to propose this bill alongside an older cousin of his, and he was more spared in the bait, Jefferson was, because he was young, but his older cousin just had heaps of scorn put on him by the other members of the legislature for saying something so preposterous. Right. So that didn't work. So then Jefferson, as a young lawyer, attempted to change things by arguing pro bono on behalf of individuals in lawsuits to try to gain their freedom. We have six examples of this, and as far as we know, he failed every time. Then he tried during the Revolutionary era to write a constitution for this new, brand new state of Virginia. First, he wrote one that would have ended the slave trade coming into Virginia. That didn't take off. And then a few years later, he wrote a constitution for Virginia that would have ended both the slave trade and slavery, that would have freed every person in the state after the year 1800. But that constitution wasn't chosen either. He wrote a law dealing with federal territories called the Northwest Ordinance in 1784. And in his original version of this Northwest Ordinance, he included a proviso that would have banned slavery in all federal lands after the year 1800. That proviso failed by one vote. The guy from New Jersey was sick on the day of the vote, and so that proviso didn't pass. Now, of course, your audience might recall a few years later in 1787, the Northwest Ordinance was repassed with a law banning slavery north of the Ohio River. Right. Jefferson would have gone even further if his version had passed.
Okay. Wow.
So he had kind of a history of these different legislative and personal efforts against slavery. And as you said, he wasn't just imagining freeing his own human property. He was trying to imagine what would liberty look like for the whole state of Virginia and eventually for the nation. And he talks about in his book, Notes on the State of Virginia, a plan to free all people born after a certain date, make sure that they are educated, and then when they reach adulthood, pay for them to be sent to some other location and then supported in that other location until they become a free and independent people, a self-governing nation. And he recognizes that we might question, why not just free these people and then let them continue to work as free Americans? And Jefferson says, well, partly because white people are too prejudiced, partly because Black people will have too many memories of the injustices that have been committed against them to want to stay, and partly because we're just too different. And that's when he goes into this conversation about racial difference. But for Jefferson, it seemed to be that it would be very tricky to free this whole group of people who had been kidnapped from their homelands and so badly treated. He couldn't imagine a future, at least publicly, where these people could freely live as American citizens and all get along together. So in his mind, the most fair and hopeful solution to the problem of slavery was not just freedom, but also reparations in the form of giving these people a country of their own and supporting them until they had become successful in their project of self-government.
And was that country of their own going to be in North America, or was it going to be back in Africa?
Jefferson considered a few different options. There had been other proposals at the time that Jefferson wrote this for a colony in the Western United States. There were proposals for a colony back in Africa. And in fact, Sierra Leone and Liberia are both countries in Africa that were created by the advocates of these kinds of projects. Jefferson considered Haiti, which was a free Black Republic by the end of his life. That was a possibility. But none of these plans really worked out very well.
Right. You go into a bit an exploration, or one of those other academic questions he's trying to get to the bottom of is, what's the best way to inherit land and to shift the way in which colonists or Americans transfer land from one generation to the next? And this kind of thinking about how to do that in order to maybe provide a path for former enslaved people to inherit land. I thought that was really an interesting discussion and something he kind of drops. I got the impression he kind of drops. But this other gentleman, is it Short? Yeah, William Short, that goes with him to France when he's ambassador and is very much an acolyte of Jefferson's, and also has the same feelings, maybe even more so, more intense feelings about anti-slavery. Into traveling around and trying to see how do the Italians do it? How do the French do it? How do the Spanish do it? How do they transfer land?
Yeah, looking into their serf kind of, or tenant farmers, their sharecropping systems.
Yeah, downstream from feudalism. How are these nations doing this? And is this better than the way we would do it?
Yeah, that was such an interesting find. And another area maybe of the scholarship where people hadn't really noticed what Jefferson was planning there. There seems to be a period of time in the late 1780s when Jefferson was, as you say, the ambassador to France, where he traveled around Europe and he noticed that, first of all, Europeans, especially in France, tended to be really bad at taking care of giving everybody an opportunity to create wealth through owning land. So there was a lot of land that was just being reserved for hunting for the rich people. And there were starving peasants who had no chance in life because they could never buy some land and become a farmer. But he also noticed that in some of these regions in France and Italy in particular, there was a form of sharecropping called mitiage, which was an ancient form of sharecropping where the landowner would allow tenant farmers to live on the land, would give them tools and seed, and then the tenant farmers would repay the landowner with a portion of the crop at the end of the harvest. And Jefferson started to wonder if mitiage couldn't become a way of transitioning enslaved people in America out of slavery and into freedom. And the thought process was, people who've been enslaved all of their lives would have a very difficult time if they were just freed and abandoned. They would have a difficult time coming up with the money to purchase any land, coming up with the skills to become independent farmers, maybe even the psychologically developing the skills necessary to become self-sufficient, managing time, doing business deals. But if somebody transitioned enslaved people gradually by letting them be sharecroppers first, this could be a way of successfully moving them from slavery to freedom. And also it could be a way of showing prejudiced white slave owners that tenant farming could be just as profitable as slave labor, maybe even more so. So Jefferson started writing with his young assistant, a guy called William Short, about potentially taking this form of tenant farming and implementing it in Virginia. And he even wrote some letters discussing bringing some German farmers to Virginia, putting them on plots of land side by side with Jefferson's own slaves, and then letting them work together so that the slaves would learn how to farm by living side by side with these German workers.
Right.
Now, why the German workers,
you ask?
That's just
bizarre.
My theory is that Jefferson knew that German immigrants had done very well as farmers. They brought a lot of great agricultural knowledge with them, and that maybe they would not be prejudiced because they were not themselves slave owners and they hadn't grown up in a slave-owning society. They wouldn't have any issues working side by side with people with dark skin. So this is an idea that he tosses around, and he thinks he's going to implement this at Monticello, and this is how he's going to transition his own enslaved workers toward freedom. Unfortunately, when Jefferson comes back from being the ambassador, George Washington immediately recruits him to become part of George Washington's first cabinet.
Yeah.
And from then on, it's off to the races. Jefferson is involved in national politics. He's the vice president. He's the secretary of state. He's president. And he kind of loses sight of these plans that he had had for how to help change things for his own slaves in Virginia.
Before we get too far down that kind of presidency and post-presidency, I wanted to kind of put a bow on it. They're debating the language in the Declaration of Independence, and his colleagues are looking at the draft. And his first draft, by the way, had a complaint against the king about slavery.
That's right.
And that can be read in isolation as saying, oh, this is kind of a new thought. But your book, and you're arguing that his colleagues considering the Declaration of Independence would probably read that and say, oh, Tom, there you go again. This is not the first time Thomas Jefferson has tried to make an anti-slavery comment, or with the bills and the efforts that he's pushed since he was a young man.
Right.
So, I mean, that's not just let me see if I can sneak this past the king or sneak this past my colleagues. This is one of many persistent attempts by him to make anti-slavery comments and put it into the political realm for people to discuss and debate. And in the end, he always loses. Almost.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. This is a consistent part of his efforts as a young man to try to argue against slavery in these different ways. That's right.
So how is the book then, The Notes on the State of Virginia, which he has this amazing political career, governor, ambassador to France, secretary of state, vice president, and president. He gets the notes published. When in that stream of professional accomplishments do the notes finally get published in French and then in English? What's the history of that?
Yeah, so the history is quite confusing. You have to kind of really dig into the details to figure out when this book was published. And that's partly because Jefferson didn't want it to be published. He wanted to privately print it and circulate it just among the scientific community and then the students at the College of William and Mary. He was nervous that if it became too widely known that he was criticizing Virginia slavery the way he was, that Virginia might actually enact some laws to harm free Black people and to make life more difficult. Yeah. And he had good reason to think that. There were actually efforts in the 1780s when people tried to petition for freedom. The legislature sometimes reacted by saying, okay, we're just going to make it harder for you to free your slaves to protect the system. Yeah. So Jefferson didn't want to publish this book widely. He wasn't on the hunt for an agent or anything. He privately printed copies in 1785 and privately circulated these copies. However, one of the copies, through a really interesting story about a British spy who betrayed Jefferson's friendship and then died in poverty in France, one of these copies fell into the hands of an unscrupulous French publisher. And so the French publisher decided to get it translated into French and then put out a French edition, which Jefferson hated, but he had to go along with it. So it comes out in French in 1785.
Okay.
And then 2 years later, Jefferson authorizes an official version in English. So 1787 is the year that Jefferson's own version of this book officially becomes published. And it's been in print ever since.
And were there changes he made from the from the unwanted French version to the approved English version, other than the language and the translation? In other words, did that publisher change things or cut out things? Or
he didn't do anything too substantive to the text itself, okay, but just the way that it was published, kind of the different images and things like that. And yeah, Jefferson didn't approve of it all.
Yeah.
Okay. The translation of some of the words as well, he would have disagreed with.
When he makes this book available then to the students at the College of William and Mary, who are some of those students?
Well, one gentleman that people might recognize the name of, who was a reader of this book when he was at the College of William and Mary, was Union General Winfield Scott.
Yeah.
So one of the generals who helps Abraham Lincoln fight against slavery in the Civil War.
Right.
Winfield Scott was a young man in the early 1800s at the College of William and Mary. And when he wrote his memoirs many years later, he recalled that he and just about all of his classmates became convinced that slavery was wrong because they read Jefferson's book while they were young men at the college. Another young man who was there around the same time was a gentleman called Edward Coles. And okay. Edward Coles would later become the governor of Illinois.
Okay.
Coles is also famous. Some people might be familiar with him because of a letter he wrote to Jefferson in 1814. At the time, Coles was a young man, and he had become persuaded that slavery was wrong, partly because of reading Jefferson's book. And he had decided that he would free all of the slaves that he inherited from his father's estate. And at the time in Virginia, the law said you could free slaves, but then you had to make them leave the state within 1 year, or else they would be re-enslaved. So Coles decided the best thing that he could do for these people is not just hand them their freedom and then abandon them and kind of force them to have to flee the state, but he could take them out of the state himself and set them up and help them live lives of freedom in a free state. So he picked Illinois. Okay. And he wrote to Thomas Jefferson to tell him about this plan and to ask Jefferson if Jefferson wouldn't please speak up more and become a louder advocate for abolition in 1814. And Jefferson wrote back, and his letter is often misunderstood as Jefferson kind of saying, Edward Coles, you know, sit down and shut up and don't free your slaves. It's useless. Actually, what Jefferson says, if you read it carefully, is don't leave the state, Edward Coles, because people like you need to lead the charge. Your generation is coming into power. My generation is old and retired. It's up to you guys to change the laws. And so you, Edward Coles, should become the leader of the anti-slavery movement. Everybody already knows what I think. I've published my book.
Right.
You're the one who needs to lead this, and I'll pray for you. Yeah. Well, Coles doesn't like this answer. He takes his slaves. He frees them on the Ohio River as they float out of the state. He reads them the Declaration of Independence. They get to Illinois. He sets them up on farms. He discovers that there's a pro-slavery movement in Illinois. And so in order to defeat them, he runs for governor on an anti-slavery platform and kind of preserves freedom in the state of Illinois. And then many years later, Edward Coles writes to Thomas Jefferson's grandson, who's just been elected to the Virginia legislature, and encourages Thomas Jefferson's grandson to stand up and argue on behalf of emancipation in him, in his grandfather's name, in the Virginia Assembly in 1831.
Wow.
And Jefferson's grandson does. It's 1831. It's the wake of the Nat Turner slave revolt. Virginians are panicking about slavery. They consider freeing their slaves for about 5 minutes. And Jefferson's grandson is the one standing there in the legislature saying, my grandfather always thought we had to free our slaves. We cannot be a republic without freeing our slaves, without truly living up to these principles of the Declaration. Right. And unfortunately, that fails again. But he does make this kind of noble effort that I think would have made Jefferson proud if he had lived to see it.
Well, certainly there's been a lot of talk since the Civil War about Robert E. Lee's loyalty to Virginia versus the loyalty to the United States. And growing up, it was kind of seen as, well, he did what everyone around him was doing. But when I saw this, you're mentioned in there toward the end of your book about Winfield Scott, and I realized, well, yeah, he's a Virginian. And oh, by the way, he stays with the United States.
Excellent point.
West Point grad, just like Robert E. Lee.
Yeah.
And I came across something recently that you may not have heard, but when when Lincoln is being elected in 1860-1861, they are going to, of course, they're going to validate the Electoral College results in Congress. And this is from a book called West Pointers in the Civil War. When Scott heard rumors that Southerners would try to disrupt the Electoral College balloting on February 13, 1861, he declared that anyone interfering, quote, should be lashed to the muzzle of a 12-pounder gun and fired out of the window of the Capitol. It is my duty to suppress insurrection. My duty, unquote.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
So my goodness.
Well, Scott was quite the energetic guy. And of course, very effective general in the Mexican War. And didn't rise to the rank of being the commander of the U.S. Army for being a wallflower. So,
wow, yeah.
But it was very interesting to see now in your book where he came to those ideas, not only supporting the Union, which is how very much how that quote can be read, but also the fact that he was anti-slavery, and that when other Virginians were choosing to leave the Union and fight for the Confederacy, he was not. And you could say the argument why he wasn't was because of Thomas Jefferson, a student of his. Who is St. George Tucker? And you talk about his work quite a bit toward the end of the book, and wanted to give you a moment to kind of walk through impact of him too.
Yeah. So St. George Tucker is another professor at William and Mary, another kind of important Virginian figure. And he is another person who was aware of Thomas Jefferson's book, Notes on the State of Virginia, kind of read this book. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote his own book to try to propose a different plan for ending slavery in the state of Virginia. And in some ways, he went further than Jefferson, and in other ways, his plan would have taken an even longer amount of time before people had found themselves freed from slavery. Mm-hmm. But he's an interesting figure because he shows that Jefferson kind of set the tone of the debate over slavery for the next several years when he published his book, Notes on the State of Virginia. Many people, both North and South, were reading this book, and a lot of Northerners thought that this was a great example of an anti-slavery book. A lot mm-hmm. of Southerners were very angry at Jefferson and mm-hmm. thought that he was a traitor to kind of the Southern way of life, and that what he said was actually very dangerous, that it might be seen as promoting abolition, which could undermine the Southern economy and maybe even produce slave revolts. So George Tucker is a good example of somebody who read this book and tried to build on Jefferson's work. Again, he as well was unsuccessful and did not get a lot of other Virginian legislatures to agree with him enough to actually change the laws in any significant way.
Just one more point, I guess, to make is the context of the time and matters too. You mentioned Haiti as a place where American former slaves might go. Of course, there's a massive slave revolt in Haiti in 1804, 1805, 1806. So just as the nation has purchased the Louisiana Purchase, or South Dakota is today, there's it. But the impact of that result in America is kind of like I told you so. Well, between Nat Turner in the 1830s, but also the very bloody revolt that goes on in the Revolution, the Civil War that goes on in Haiti, it just seems to amp up the pro-slavery sentiment in the Southern United States. Really feed, I guess, the point is, it feeds upon the fear of giving an education to, or certainly freeing some, mm-hmm. would just wind up visiting violence upon us all. I think they take that Haiti example and the Nat Turner example in the 1830s and use it as a cudgel to argue against freedom of slavery, or even educating those who are enslaved.
Yeah, you know, Jefferson had argued in the 1780s that the best way to solve the problem of slavery was to free the enslaved people, but also then to give them a separate nation of their own. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the Haitian Revolution, as you mentioned, it was an extremely bloody revolution. It ended with just about every white person in Haiti being murdered. And a lot of Virginians and other Southern slaveholders were absolutely terrified that the same thing could happen in America, that there could be a successful slave uprising, And that if an uprising happened, that there would be no mercy shown. So it just seemed to kind of add further ammunition to this argument that enslaved people could not be freed and then incorporated into the Republic on equal terms, that there would always be this enmity and this danger. And that really complicated the question of, well, how do we free the slaves if we can't do that without then also moving them somewhere else? What a tremendous expense, and what a very difficult project. And that really became an excuse not to do anything about slavery, because it just seemed like an overwhelming problem.
Well, as the nation gets prepared to mark the 250th birthday of Thomas Jefferson's work and the Declaration of Independence, I know it's a bit of a parlor game, but what do you think he would say about the route to the ending of slavery, about how it did transpire ultimately with the Civil War and the Civil Rights Act, yet a century later?
I think that Jefferson wouldn't have been surprised by the Civil War. Mm-hmm. I think he predicted it. He really worried, for example, in 1820 with the Missouri Compromise, he really worried that the Missouri Compromise line and this idea of trying to stop slavery from spreading by enacting these laws, keeping it to the southern states. He said that drawing a line across the country and having it be linked to this moral and political controversial principle would just make everybody hate each other more, would just deepen the crisis. And he was so right.
He was very right.
So he wouldn't have been surprised. In his own family, some of his descendants, some of his grandchildren fought for the Union, and others fought for the Confederacy. Even in the Jefferson family, you see this tearing apart over the issue of slavery. So I don't know with 100% certainty what Jefferson himself would have done, but I believe he would have fought for Union over the ideals of the Confederacy, because the Confederates, they outright rejected him. They outright rejected his ideas. They said equality was a lie and a myth, that white supremacy was the basis of the Confederacy. And I think that Jefferson not only would have rejected that, but also that he would be very pleased that society has progressed morally. And he did say over and over that he hoped as the light of science and education spread, as enlightenment continued, that Americans would grow in their moral principles, that they would create a better and more just society. One could very much see in Jefferson's own ideas that the society that we've built now based on civil rights and equality aligns with the principles that he espoused back in the 1700s.
Right.
So, of course, we can't say with 100% certainty, but I choose to believe that Jefferson would be pleased.
Right. Well, it's important, too, I guess, that I'm realizing here, I skipped in my notes the question about Sally Hemings. You don't skip that topic in your book at all, and readers can dive in there. But I guess, briefly, what does it say about his anti-slavery views regarding the races and so forth to have children with, I mean, you come down very much so on the fact that those were his kids, that he fathered those children. That was how I got it out of your book, that you really don't spend much time on that debate.
Yeah,
and you
I would
just
say it's
assume
like
that that's
95%.
True.
Yes.
Right.
I leave open the door for future research, because I think that there's some DNA testing that's been done, but it's not definitive.
Yeah.
And there are still arguments that are being made about this issue. So I don't think that we can know with 100% certainty that Thomas Jefferson was the father of Sally Hemings's children, but it seems very likely. And if it is likely, then I do try to offer my explanations as to how we can still understand Jefferson if that story is indeed true.
Mm-hmm. And the relationship they had is certainly a complicated one. And I was reminded that she is his late wife's cousin.
Half sister.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Even worse.
Yeah. Tangled web we weave, right?
Yeah. Yeah. His late wife's father had an enslaved woman that he had several children with. And Sally Hemings was one of those children of this enslaved woman. And then when Jefferson's father-in-law passed away, that enslaved woman and her children came to live at Monticello.
Yeah.
It's a very tangled web indeed.
Yeah. As a person who might point at that and say hypocrisy again or so forth, how do you, what does that relationship then reveal about his understanding of slavery and its role in society, or
so,
anti-slavery and his desire for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Thomas Jefferson, he became the owner of the entire Hemmings family, as we've said. And mm-hmm. Sally Hemmings had a son called Madison who was living in Freedom in Ohio in the 1830s, gave an interview where he told his story about his mother, Sally Hemmings. And the way that he told the story was Sally Hemmings was with Thomas Jefferson in France when Jefferson was ambassador. And she became aware that she was free in France because that was the state of the law in France at the time. Mm-hmm. And if she had wanted to, she could have remained as a free woman in France. She didn't legally have to go back with Jefferson to Virginia. And according to Madison Hemmings, his mother came to a deal with Thomas Jefferson that she would return with him to America, that she would have an easy life, and that all of her children, presumably her children with Thomas Jefferson, would be freed when they reached adulthood. And in fact, all of Sally Hemmings's children did become free, either because they were allowed to simply leave Monticello and were mm-hmm. not chased, were in fact encouraged to leave, or because mm-hmm. they were freed in Jefferson's will. Mm. So if that Madison Hemmings's story is accurate, we have an example of the closest thing to consent that could have been possible in that kind of a situation, where Sally Hemmings actually had the chance to leave mm-hmm. and, according to her own son, chose to remain with Thomas Jefferson and chose to exercise her own agency within the context yeah. of that relationship, even though there was obviously still a power imbalance.
Yeah.
And the foremost historian of Sally Hemmings is a Harvard professor named Annette Gordon Reed. She strongly believes that love was even possible, even within the confines of this power imbalance and this unjust system of slavery, and that it's possible that Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemmings had a long, companionable relationship with one another. Now, of course, that still is very unsatisfying to us, right, as it was to Madison Hemmings, and I'm sure to Thomas mm-hmm. Jefferson and Sally Hemmings themselves. But what does it open up for us in terms of Thomas Jefferson? It maybe means that Thomas Jefferson privately believed that a multiracial future for America was actually possible. Yeah. He would not have said that publicly. It would have mm-hmm. caused far too much of a scandal. But privately, he seems to have, at the very least, been aware that interracial relationships were common, that the children of such relationships were beautiful, intelligent people, and that the country didn't fall down because, you know, African Americans yeah. and white Americans were having these interactions. So it's right. possible that in his private life, he was even more progressive than what we previously had thought possible.
Fascinating conversation, Kara. Thanks a lot for joining us today, and I hope people check out the book and give it a good read, and it's because it's a lot to ponder, a lot to chew on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruer for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.